Chapter 38 Hidden Faces. The Garden of Silver Breezes was not a garden at all, but a huge wine shop, much too large to be called a shop, really, atop a hill centered on the Calpena, the westernmost of Tanchico's three peninsulas below the Great Circle. A part of the name, at least, came from the breezes that wafted in, where polished green-streaked marble columns and balustrades replaced one wall, except on the topmost floor. Golden oiled silk curtains could be lowered in case of rain. The hill fell away sharply on that side, and the tables along the balustrades gave a clear view, across white domes and spires, of the great harbor, crowded with more ships than ever. Tanchico needed everything desperately, and there was gold to be made, until the gold and time ran out. With its gilded lamps and ceilings inlaid with brass fretwork polished to a golden gleam, its serving women and men chosen for grace and beauty and discretion, the Garden of the Silver Breezes had been the most expensive wine shop in the city, even before the troubles. Now it was outrageous. But those who dealt in huge sums still came, those who dealt in power and influence, or thought they did. In some ways there was less to deal in than before, in others, more. Low walls surrounded each table, making islands dotted across the green and golden floor tiles, each wall pierced with lacy carving so no eavesdropper could listen unseen, stood just high enough to hide who met whom from the casual glances of passers-by. Even so, patrons usually went masked, especially of late, and some had a bodyguard beside their table, also masked to avoid recognition if the patron was prudent. And tongueless, rumor said, for the most prudent. No guard was visibly armed. The proprietress of the Garden of Silver Breezes, a sleek woman of indeterminate age named Celindrin, allowed no weapons past the street now. Her rule was not broken, at least openly. From her usual table against the balustrade, Egyanin watched the ships in the harbor, especially those under sail. They made her want to be back on a deck, giving orders. She had never expected duty to bring her to this. Unconsciously, she adjusted the velvet mask that hid the upper half of her face. She felt ridiculous wearing the thing, but it was necessary to blend in to some extent. The mask, blue to match her high-necked silk gown, the gown itself, and her dark hair, grown down to her shoulders now, were as far as she could make herself go. Passing for a Tarabonner was unnecessary. Tanchico bulged with refugees, a good many of them foreigners swept up in the troubles, and it was beyond her in any case. These people were animals. They had no discipline, no order. Regretfully, she turned from the harbor to her table companion, a narrow-faced fellow with a weasel's greedy smile. Floran Gelb's frayed collar did not belong in the Garden of Silver Breezes, and he continually wiped his hands on his coat. She always met them here, the greasy little men she was forced to deal with. It was a reward for them, and a means of keeping them off balance. "What do you have for me, Master Gelb?" Wiping his hands again, he lifted a coarse jute bag onto the table and watched her anxiously. She held the bag down beside her before opening it. A silvery metal eidom lay inside, a collar and bracelet connected by a leash, cunningly worked and joined. She closed the bag and set it on the floor. This made three that Gelb had recovered, more than anyone else. "Very good, Master Gelb." A small purse went across the table the other way. Gelb made it disappear under his coat as if it held the Empress's crown instead of a handful of silver. "And do you have anything else?" "Those women. The ones you want me to look for?" She had grown used to the quick speech of these people, but she wished he would not lick his lips that way. It did not make him any harder to understand, but it was unsightly. She very nearly told him she was not interested anymore, but this was a part of why she was in Tanchico after all, maybe the whole reason now. What of them? That she could even think of shirking her duty made her speak more harshly than she had intended, and Gelb flinched. I think I've found another one. You are sure? There have been mistakes. Mistakes was a gentle way to put it. Near a dozen women who came only vaguely near the descriptions had been nuisances she could ignore once she had seen them. But that noblewoman, a refugee from estates burned out by the war. Gelb had kidnapped the woman off the street, thinking to earn more for delivering her than for telling where she was. In his defense, the Lady Lylwyn closely matched one of the women Egyanin sought, but she had told him they would not speak with any accent he recognized, certainly not a Tarabonar accent. Egyanin had not wanted to kill the woman, yet even in Tanchico someone might have listened to her story. Lylwyn had gone bound and gagged onto one of the courier boats in the dead of night. She was young and pretty, and someone would find a better use for her than slitting her throat. But Egyanin was not in Tanchico to find serving girls for the blood. "No mistakes, Mistress Elidar," he said hastily, flashing that smile full of teeth. "Not this time, but I need a little gold, to be sure, to get close enough. 4 or 5 crowns? "I pay for results," Egyanin told him firmly. "After your mistakes, you are lucky that I pay you at all." Gelb licked his lips nervously. "You said, back in the beginning, you said you'd have a few coins for those as could do special sorts of work." A muscle in his cheek twitched. His eyes darted, as if someone might be listening at the lace-carved wall around 3 sides of the table, and his voice dropped to a hoarse whisper. "Stirring up trouble, as it were? I heard a rumor, from a fellow who's body servant to Lord Brees, about the assembly and choosing the new Panarch. I think maybe it's true. The man was drunk, and when he realized what he had said, he nearly fouled himself. Even if it isn't, it would still rip Tanchico wide open." "Do you really believe there is any need to buy trouble in this city? Tanchico was a rotting bell fruit ready to fall in the first wind. The whole of this wretched land was." For a moment she was tempted to buy his rumor. She was supposed to be a trader in whatever goods or information came along, and she had even sold some. But dealing with Gelb sickened her, and her own doubts frightened her. "That will be all, Master Gelb. You know how to make contact with me if you find another of these." She touched the rough-woven sack. Instead of rising, he sat staring, trying to see through her mask. "Where are you from, Mistress Elidar? The way you talk, all slurred out and soft-like, begging your pardon, no offense meant, I can't place you." "That will be all, Gelb." Maybe it was the quarterdeck voice, or maybe the mask failed to hide her cold stare, but Gelb bounced to his feet, ducking bows and stammering apologies while he fumbled open the door in the lacework wall. She sat there after he was gone, giving him time to leave the Garden of Silver Breezes. Someone would follow him outside to make certain he did not wait to shadow her. All this skulking and hiding disgusted her. She almost wished something would destroy her disguise and give her an honest face-to-face fight. A new ship was sweeping into the harbor below, a seafolk raker with its towering masts and clouds of sail. She had examined a captured raker, but she would have given almost anything to take one out, though she expected a seafolk crew would be necessary to wring the most from the vessel. The Atha'an Mi'er were stubborn about taking the oaths. It would not be as good if she had to buy a crew. Buy an entire crew. The amount of gold that came in by the courier boats for her to fling about was going to her head. Taking up the jute bag, she started to rise, then sat back down hurriedly at the sight of a wide, thick-shouldered man leaving another table. Dark hair long to his shoulders and a beard that left his upper lip bare framed Bale Domon's round face. He was not masked, of course. He ran a dozen coasting vessels in and out of Tanchico, and apparently did not care who knew his whereabouts. Masked. She was not thinking straight. He would not recognize her in a mask. Still, she waited until he was gone before leaving her table. The man might have to be dealt with yet, if he became a danger. Celindrin took the gold she proffered with a sleek smile and murmured wishes for Egyanin's continued patronage. Dark hair and dozens of narrow braids, the proprietress of the Garden of Silver Breezes wore clinging white silk, nearly thin enough for a serving girl, and one of those transparent veils that always made Egyanin want to ask Taraboners what dances they could perform. Shay dancers wore almost identical veils and little more. Still, Egyanin thought as she started toward the street, the woman had a sharp mind, else she could not maneuver through the shoals of Tanchico, catering to every faction while earning the enmity of none. A reminder of that was the tall, white-cloaked man, gray at the temples but hard-faced and hard-eyed, who passed Egyanin and was greeted by Celindrin. Jakim Karadin's cloak bore a golden sunburst on the breast, with four golden knots below and a crimson shepherd's crook behind. An inquisitor of the Hand of the Light, a high officer in the Children of the Light. The very concept of the Children outraged Egyanin, a military body answerable only to itself. But Karadin and his few hundred soldiers had power of a sort in Tanchico, where any kind of authority seemed to be lacking most of the time. The civil watch no longer patrolled the streets, and the army, as much as was still loyal to the king, was too busy holding the fortresses around the city. Egyanin noted that Celindrin did not even glance at the sword on Karadin's hip. He definitely had power. As soon as she stepped into the street, her bearers came running with her chair from the cluster waiting for their patrons, and her bodyguards closed in around her with their spears. They were a mismatched lot, some in steel caps, three wearing leather shirts sewn with steel scales, rough-faced men, possibly deserters from the army, but aware that continued full bellies and silver to spend depended on her continued safety. Even the bearers carried stout knives and cudgels stuck out of their sashes. No one who looked as though they had money dared appear out of doors unguarded. In any case, had she cared to risk it, it would only draw attention to her. The guards forced a way through the crowds with no trouble. The throngs eddied and swirled in the narrow streets that wound through the city's hills, creating clear pockets around sedan chairs surrounded by bodyguards. There were very few carriages to be seen. Horses were becoming an extravagance. Worn was the only fit description for the milling masses. Worn and frenzied. Worn faces, worn clothes, and two bright, frenzied eyes, desperate, hoping when they knew there was no hope. Many had surrendered, crouching against walls, huddled in doorways, clutching wives, husbands, children, not simply worn but ragged and blank-faced. Sometimes they roused enough to cry out to some passerby for a coin, a crust, anything. Egyanin kept her eyes straight ahead, of necessity trusting the bodyguards to detect any danger. Meeting a beggar's eyes meant 20 of them jamming themselves hopefully around her chair. Tossing a coin meant 100 crowding in, clamoring and weeping. She was already using part of the money the courier boats brought to support a soup kitchen, just as if she were one of the blood. She shuddered to think what discovery of that overstepping of her place would mean. As well put on a brocaded robe and shave her head. All of this could be put aright once Tanchico fell, with everyone fed, everyone put in their proper place. And she could abandon dresses and things she had no experience or taste for, return to her ship. Taraban, at least, and perhaps Arad Doman as well, were ready to crumble at a touch, like charred silk. Why was the High Lady Suroth holding back? Why?
Jakim Karadin, lounged in his chair, cloak spread over the carved arms, studying the Terrabanner nobleman who occupied the private room's other chairs. They sat stiffly in their gold-embroidered coats, mouths tight below masks, fancifully worked to resemble hawks' faces and lions and leopards. He had more to worry him than they, but he managed a calm demeanor. It was 2 months since he had received word of a cousin found skinned alive in his own bedchamber, 3 since his youngest sister, Dialda, being carried off from a bridal feast by a murdrawl. The family steward wrote disbelievingly, frantic with all the tragedy befalling House Carradine. 2 months. He hoped Dialda had died quickly. It was said women did not cling to sanity long in murdrawl hands. 2 whole months. Anyone else but J. Kim Carradine would have been sweating blood. Each man held a golden goblet of wine, but there were no servants present. Cylindrin had served them before removing herself with an assurance that they would not be disturbed. There was, in fact, no one else on this, the highest floor of the Garden of Silver Breezes. 2 men who had come with the nobles, members of the king's lifeguard, unless Carradine missed his guess, stood at the foot of the stairs to guarantee continued privacy. Carradine sipped his wine. None of the Tarabonners had touched theirs. "So," he said lightly, "King Andric wishes the Children of the Light to aid in restoring order in the city. We do not often let ourselves become involved in the internal affairs of nations. Not openly." "Certainly I cannot remember such a request. I do not know what the Lord Captain Commander will say. Pedron Nile would say to do what was needed and make sure the Tarabonners knew that they owed a debt to the children. Make sure they paid it in full." "There is no time for you to request instructions from Amador," a man in a black-spotted leopard mask said urgently. None had offered names, but Carradine did not need them. "We ask what is necessary," another snapped, his thick mustache below a hawk mask giving him the look of a peculiar owl. "You must understand that we would not make this request unless it were necessary in the extreme. We must have unity, not more division, yes? There are many divisive elements, even within Tunchico. They must be suppressed if there is to be even the hope of imposing peace on the countryside. The death of the Panarch has made matters most difficult," the first fellow added. Carradine raised an eyebrow questioningly. "Have you discovered yet who killed her?" His own supposition was that Andric himself had had the deed done, in the belief that the Panarch favored one of the rebel claimants to the throne. The king may have been right, but he had discovered after calling what he could of the Assembly of Lords, a good many were with one or another of the rebel groups out in the country, that they were remarkably stubborn about ratifying his choice. Even had the Lady Amathera not been currently sharing Andric's bed, election of king and Panarch was the only real power the Assembly had, and they did not seem to want to give it up. The difficulties over the Lady Amathera were not supposed to be known. Even the Assembly realized that that news might set off riots. "One of the dragon-sworn madmen, assuredly," the owl-looking man said, giving his mustache a fierce tug. "No true Tarabonner would harm the Panarch, yes?" He almost sounded as if he believed it. "Of course," Carradine said smoothly. He took another sip of wine. "If I am to secure the Panarch's palace for the ascension of the Lady Amathera, I must hear from the king himself. Otherwise, it might appear the Children of the Light were reaching for power in Taraban, when all we seek is, as you say, an end to division and peace under the light." An older, square-jawed leopard, white-streaking his dark yellow hair, spoke up in cold tones.
"I have heard that Pedron Nile seeks unity against the Dragon Sworn. Unity under himself, is it not?"
"The Lord Captain Commander seeks no dominion," Carradine replied, just as icily. "The children serve the light, as do all men of goodwill."
"There can be no question," the first leopard put in, "of Taraban being subject in any way to Amador. No question."
angry agreement rumbled from nearly every chair. "Of course not," Carradine said, as though the thought had never crossed his mind. "If you wish my aid, I will give it, under the conditions I have stated. If you do not, there is always work for the children. Service to the light never ends, for the shadow waits everywhere."
"You will have sureties signed and sealed by the king," a graying, lion-masked man said, the first words he had spoken. He was, of course, Andric himself, though Carradine was not supposed to know. The king could not meet with an inquisitor of the Hand of the Light without causing talk, any more than he could visit a wine shop, even the Garden of Silver Breezes. Carradine nodded. "When they are in my hand, I will secure the Panarch's palace, and the children will suppress any divisive elements who attempt to interfere with the investiture. Under the light, I swear it." Tension drained out of the Tarabonners visibly. They upended their goblets as if trying to replace it with wine. Even Andric. So far as the people of Tarabon were concerned, the children would have the blame for the inevitable killings, not the king, or the army of Tarabon. Once Amathera was invested with the crown and staff of the tree, a few more of the assembly might well join the rebels. But if the rest admitted they had not elected her, the news would set Tanchico afire. As for any tales that came from those who fled, why, rebels would spread any sort of treasonous lie. And the king and Panarch of Tarabon would both dangle on strings Carradine could hand to Pedron Nile to do with as he pleased. Not such a grand prize as it would have been when the king of Tarabon controlled more than a few hundred square miles around Tanchico, yet it might be grand again. With the aid of the children, a legion or two would be needed at least, not just the 500 men Carradine had. The dragon sworn might yet be crushed, the various rebels defeated, even the war with Ara-Doman successfully prosecuted, if either country still realized it was fighting the other. Ara-Doman was in worse condition than Tarabon, so Carradine had heard. In truth, he hardly cared if Tarabon fell under the children's sway, or Tanchico, or any of it. There were motions to go through, things to do that he had always done, but it was difficult to think of anything except when his own throat would be cut. Perhaps he would long to have his throat cut. 2 whole months since the last report. He did not stay to drink with the Tarabonners, but made his goodbyes as shortly as he could. If they took offense, they needed him too much to show it. Salindrin saw him come down, and a stable boy was trotting his horse up to the front door when he reached the street. Tossing the boy a copper, he spurred the black gelding to a quick canter. The ragged folk in the twisty streets got out of his way, which was to the good. He was not sure he would notice if he trampled one of them. Not that it would be any loss. The city was full of beggars. He could hardly breathe without the stench of old sour sweat and dirt. Tamrin ought to sweep them up and sweep them out. Let the rebels in the country contend with them. It was the country that held his mind, but not the rebels. They could be dealt with easily enough, after word began to spread that this one or that was a dark friend. And once he managed to turn a few of them over to the Hand of the Light, they would stand up before everyone and confess to worshipping the Dark One, eating children, anything and everything they were told. The rebels could not last long after that. The pretenders, still in the field, would wake to find themselves alone. But the dragon sworn, the men and women who had actually declared for the dragon reborn, would not fall away for a charge of being dark friends. Most people already considered them so, swearing to follow a man who could channel. It was the man they had sworn to follow who was the problem. The man whose name they did not even know. Randall Thor. Where was he?
100 bands of dragonsworn out there, at least 2 large enough to be called armies, fighting the king's army, such of it as still held allegiance to Andric, fighting the rebels, who were busy fighting each other as often as Andric or the dragonsworn. Yet Caradin had no clue to which band sheltered Randall Thor. He could be on Almuth Plain or in Ara Doman, where the situation was the same. If he was, Jaqim Caradin was a dead man in all likelihood. At the palace on the Varana he had commandeered for the children's headquarters, he tossed his reins to one of the white-cloaked guards and stalked inside without returning their salutes. The owner of this ornate mass of pale domes and lacy spires and shaded gardens had put forward a claim to the throne of the light, and no one complained at the occupation. Least of all the owner. What was left of his head still adorned a spike above the traitor's steps on the meseta. For once Caradin barely glanced at the fine Taraban carpets, or furnishings worked with gold and ivory, or fountained courts where splashing water made a cool sound. Broad hallways with golden lamps and high ceilings covered in delicate goldwork scrolls interested him not at all. This palace could match the finest in Amadisia, if not the largest. Yet foremost in his mind right then was the strong brandy in the room he had taken for a study. He was halfway across a priceless carpet, all patterned blue and scarlet and gold, eyes fixed on the carved cabinet that held a silver flask of double-distilled brandy, when suddenly he realized he was not alone. A woman in a clinging pale red gown stood near the tall, narrow windows overlooking one of the tree-shaded gardens, her honey-colored hair in braids that brushed her shoulders. A misty scrap of veil did nothing to hide her face. Young and pretty, with a rosebud mouth and large brown eyes, she was no servant, not dressed like that.
"Who are you?" he demanded irritably. "How did you get in here? Leave at once, or I'll have you tossed into the street."
"Threats, Bors. You should be more welcoming to a guest, yes?"
That name jolted him to his heels. Before he thought, he had his sword out, lunging for her throat. Something seized him. The air turned to crawling jelly. Something forced him to his knees, encased him from the neck down. It tightened around his wrist until bones grated. His hand popped open, and his sword fell. The power. She was using the one power on him. A Tarvalan witch. And if she knew that name...
"Do you remember," she said, coming closer, "a meeting where Baal Zaman himself appeared and showed us the faces of Matrim Cawthon and Perane Barra and Randall Thor?"
She practically spat the names, especially the last. Her eyes could have drilled holes in steel.
"You see, I know who you are, yes? You pledged your soul to the great lord of the Dark Boars."
Her sudden laugh was a tinkling of bells. Sweat popped out on his face. Not just a despised Tarvalan witch. Black Aja. She was Black Aja. He had thought it would be a murderer that came for him. He had thought there was time yet, more time. Not yet.
"I tried to kill him," he babbled. "Randall Thor, I have tried, but I cannot find him. I cannot. I was told my family would be killed if I failed, one by one. I was promised I would be the last. I have cousins yet, nephews, nieces. I have another sister. You must give me more time."
She stood there, watching him with those sharp brown eyes, smiling with that plump little mouth, listening to him spew out where Venora could be found, where her bedchamber lay, how she liked to ride alone in the forest beyond Carmera. Perhaps if he shouted, some of the guards would come. Perhaps they could kill her. He opened his mouth wider, and that thick, invisible jelly oozed in, forcing his jaws apart until they creaked in his ears. Nostrils flaring, he sucked air in frantically. He could still breathe, but he could not scream. All that came out were muffled groans.
like a woman wailing behind walls. He wanted to scream.
"You are very amusing," the honey-haired woman said finally. "Jacob? That is a good name for a dog, I think. Would you like to be my dog, Jacob? If you are a very good dog, I may allow you to watch Randolph or die one day. Yes?"
It took a moment for what she was saying to sink in. If he was to see Randolph Thor die, she was not going to kill him, skin him alive, do the things his mind had conjured that would make flaying a release. Tears rolled down his face. Sobs of relief shook him, as much as he could shake, trapped as he was. That trap abruptly vanished, and he collapsed on hands and knees, still weeping. He could not stop. The woman knelt beside him and tangled a hand in his hair, pulled his head up.
"Now, you listen to me, yes?
The death of Randolph Thor is for the future, and you will see it only if you are a good dog. You are going to move your white cloaks to the Panarch's palace."
How do you know that?"
She shook his head from side to side, not gently. "A good dog does not question his mistress. I throw the stick, you fetch the stick. I say kill, you kill. Yes? Yes." Her smile was just a flash of teeth.
"There will be difficulty in taking the palace. The Panarch's Legion is there. 1,000 men sleeping in the hallways, the exhibition rooms, the courtyards. You do not have so many of your white cloaks."
He had to stop and swallow. "They will make no trouble. They will believe Amathera has been chosen by the Assembly. It is the Assembly that..."
"Do not bore me, Jacob. I do not care if you kill the entire Assembly, so long as you hold the Panarch's palace." "When will you move?"
It will take 3 or 4 days for Andric to deliver sureties."
3 or 4 days, she murmured, half to herself. "Very well, a little longer delay should cause no harm."
He was wondering what delay she meant when she cut away the little ground remaining under his feet.
"You will keep control of the palace, and you will send the Panarch's fine soldiers away."
"That is impossible," he gasped.
And she jerked his head back so hard he did not know if his neck would break or his scalp tear loose first. He did not dare resist. 1,000 invisible needles pricked him, on his face, his chest, his back, arms, legs, everywhere. Invisible, but he was sure no less real for that.
"Impossible, Jacob," she said softly. "Impossible is a word I do not like to hear."
The needles twisted deeper. He groaned, but he had to explain. What she wanted was impossible. He panted with haste.
"Once Amathera is invested as Panarch, she will control the Legion. If I try to hold the palace, she will turn them on me, and Andric will help her. There is no way I can hold it against the Panarch's Legion, and against whatever Andric can strip from the ring forts."
She studied him so long, he began to sweat. He did not dare to flinch, hardly even to blink. Those 1,000 biting little stabs did not allow it.
"The Panarch will be dealt with," she said finally.
The needles vanished, and she stood. Carradine stood too, trying to steady himself. Perhaps some bargain could be reached. The woman seemed willing to listen to reason now. His legs quivered with shock, but he made his voice as firm as he could.
"Even if you can influence Amathera," she cut him off. "I told you not to question, Jacob. A good dog obeys his mistress, yes?
I promise you, if you do not, you will beg me to find a murderer to play with you. Do you understand me?"
"I understand," he said leadenly.
She continued to stare, and after a moment he did understand.
"I will do as you say, mistress."
Her brief, approving smile made him flush. She moved toward the door, turning her back on him as if he really were a dog, and a toothless one.
What is your name?
Her smile was sweet this time, and mocking. Yes, a dog should know his mistress's name. I am called Leandrin, but that name must never touch a dog's lips. Should it, I will be most displeased with you.
When the door closed behind her, he staggered to a high-backed chair inlaid with ivory and fell into it. The brandy he left where it was, the way his stomach was twisting, it would make him vomit. What interest could she possibly have in the Panarch's palace? A dangerous line of questioning, perhaps, but even if they served the same master, he could not feel anything but revulsion for a Tarvalan witch. She did not know as much as she thought. With the king's sureties in hand, he could keep Tamrin and the army away from his throat with the threat of revelation, and Amathera, too. They could still rouse the mob, though, and the Lord Captain Commander might be more than disapproving of the entire affair, might believe he was reaching for personal power. Carradine dropped his head in his hands, envisioning Niall signing his death warrant. His own men would arrest him and hang him. If he could arrange the death of the witch. But she had promised to protect him from the murdral. He wanted to weep again. She was not even here, yet she had him trapped as tightly as ever, steel jaws clamped on both legs and a noose snug around his neck. There had to be a way out, but every way he looked, there was only another trap.
Leandrin ghosted through the halls, easily avoiding servants and white cloaks. When she stepped out of a small back door into a narrow alley behind the palace, the tall young guard there stared at her with a blend of relief and unease. Her little trick of opening someone to her suggestions, just a whip-crack trickle of the power, had not been needed with Carradine, but it had easily convinced this fool that she should be allowed in. Smiling, she motioned him to bend closer. The lanky lout grinned as if expecting a kiss, a grin that froze as her narrow blade went through his eye. She leaped nimbly back as he fell, a boneless sack of flesh. He would not speak of her even by accident now. Not so much as a spot of blood stained her hand. She wished she had Chesmal's skill at killing with the power, or even Rihanna's lesser talent. Strange that the ability to kill with the power, to stop a heart or boil blood in the veins, should be so closely linked to healing. She herself could not heal much more than scrapes or bruises, not that she had any interest in it. Her sedan chair, red-lacquered and inlaid with ivory and gold, was waiting at the end of the alley, and with it her bodyguards, a dozen big men with faces like starving wolves. Once in the streets, they cleared a path through the crowds with ease, spears clubbing any not quick enough to move aside. They were all dedicated to the great Lord of the Dark, of course, and if they did not know exactly who she was, they knew that other men had disappeared, men who failed to serve properly. The house she and the others had taken, two sprawling stories of flat-roofed stone and white plaster on a hillside at the base of the Varana, Tanchico's easternmost peninsula, belonged to a merchant who had also sworn his oaths to the great lord. Leandrin would have preferred a palace. One day, perhaps, she would have the king's palace on the Maceta. She had grown up staring enviously at the lord's palaces, but why should she settle for one of them? Yet, despite her preferences, it made sense to stay hidden a while yet. There was no way the fools in Tarvalin could suspect they were in Tarabon, but the tower was surely still hunting them, and Swan Sanche's pets could be sniffing anywhere. Gates gave onto a small courtyard, windowless except on the upper floor. Leaving the guards and bearers there, she hurried inside. The merchant had furnished a few servants, all sworn to the great lord, he assured them, but barely enough to provide for 11 women who rarely stirred outside. One, a sturdily handsome, dark-braided woman called Gildin, was sweeping the entry hall's red and white tiles when Leandrin entered. "Where are the others?" she demanded. in the front withdrawing room. Gildan gestured to the double-arch doors to the right, as though Leandrin might not know where that was. Leandrin's mouth tightened. The woman did not curtsy. She used no titles of respect. True, she did not know who Leandrin really was, but Gildan certainly knew she was high enough to give orders and be obeyed, to send that fat merchant bowing and scraping and bundling his family off to some hovel. "You are supposed to be cleaning, yes? Not standing about? Well, clean. There is dust everywhere. If I find a speck of the dust this evening, you cow, you, I will have you beaten." She clamped her teeth shut. She had copied the manner in which nobles and the wealthy spoke for so long that sometimes she forgot her father had sold fruit from a barrow, yet in one moment of anger the speech of a commoner rolled off her tongue. Too much stress, too much waiting. With a last snapped, "Work!" she pushed into the withdrawing room and slammed the door behind her. The others were not all there, which irritated her even more, but enough. Round-faced Eldrith Jondar, seated at a lapis-inlaid table beneath a hanging on one white-plastered wall, was making careful notes from a tattered manuscript. Sometimes she absently cleaned the nib of her pen on the sleeve of her dark wool dress. Marilyn Gamulfin sat beside one of the narrow windows, blue eyes dreamily staring out at the tiny fountain tinkling in a little courtyard, idly scratching the ears of a scrawny yellow cat, and apparently unaware of the hairs it shed all over her green silk dress. She and Eldrith were both browns, but if Marilyn ever found out that Eldrith was the reason the stray cats she brought in continually disappeared, there would be trouble. They had been browns. Sometimes it was difficult to remember they no longer were, or that she herself was no longer a red. So much of what had marked them clearly as members of their old Ajahs remained, even now that they were openly pledged to the black. Take the two former greens. Coppery-skinned, swan-necked Gian Kaida wore the thinnest, most clinging silk dresses she could find, white today, and laughed that the gowns would have to do, since there was nothing available in Tarabon to catch a man's eye. Gian was from Arad Doman. Domani women were infamous for their scandalous clothes. Asni Zeramin, with her dark tilted eyes and bold nose, looked almost demure in pale gray, plainly cut and high-necked, but Leandrin had heard her regret leaving her warders behind more than once. And as for Rihanna Andomaran, black hair with a stark white streak above her left ear framed a face with the cold, arrogant certainty only a white could assume. "It is done," Leandrin announced. "J. Kim Karadin will move his white cloaks to the Panarch's palace and hold it for us. He does not yet know we will have guests, of course." There were a few grimaces. Changing Ajahs had certainly not altered anyone's feelings toward men who hated women who could channel. "There is an interesting thing. He believed I was there to kill him, for failing to kill Randall Thor." "That makes no sense," Asni said, frowning. "We are to bind him, control him, not kill him." She laughed suddenly, soft and low, and leaned back in her chair. "If there is a way to control him, I would not mind binding him to me. He is a good-looking young man, from the little I saw." Leandrin sniffed. She had no liking for men at all. Rihanna shook her head worriedly. "It makes troubling sense. Our orders from the tower were clear, yet it is also clear that Karadin has others. I can only postulate dissension among the Forsaken." "The Forsaken," Jiayin muttered, folding her arms tightly. Thin white silk molded her breasts even more revealingly. "What good are promises that we will rule the world when the Great Lord returns if we are crushed between warring Forsaken first? Does anyone believe we could stand against any of them?" "Balefire." Asne looked around, dark tilted eyes challenging. "Balefire will destroy even one of the Forsaken, and we have the means to produce it." One of the Turangrial they had removed from the tower A fluted black rod a pace long had that use. None of them knew why they had been ordered to take it, not even Leandrin herself. Too many of the Turangrial were like that, taken because they had been told to, with no reasons given, but some orders had to be obeyed. Leandrin wished they had been able to secure even one Angrial. Jain gave a sharp sniff. If any of us could control it. Or have you forgotten that the one test we dared nearly killed me, and burned a hole through both sides of the ship before I could stop it? Fine good it would have done us to drown before reaching Tanchico. What need have we of balefire? Leandrin said. If we can control the Dragon Reborn, let the Forsaken think how they will deal with us. Suddenly she became aware of another presence in the room. The woman Gildan, wiping down a carved, low-backed chair in one corner. What are you doing here, woman? Cleaning. The dark-braided woman straightened unconcernedly. You told me to clean. Leandrin almost struck out with the power. Almost. But Gildan certainly did not know they were Aes Sedai. How much had the woman heard? Nothing of importance. You will go to the cook, she said in a cold fury, and tell him he is to strap you, very hard, and you are to have nothing to eat until the dust it is all gone. Again. The woman had made her speak like a commoner again. Marilyn stood, nuzzling the yellow cat's nose with hers, and handed the creature to Gildan. See that he gets a dish of cream when the cook is done with you, and some of that nice lamb. Cut it small for him. He doesn't have many teeth left, poor thing. Gildan looked at her, not blinking, and she added, Is there something you don't understand? I understand. Gildan's mouth was tight. Perhaps she did finally understand. She was a servant, not their equal. Leandrin waited a moment after she left, the cat cradled in her arms, then snatched open one of the doors. The entry hall was empty. Gildan was not eavesdropping. She did not trust the woman, but then she could not think of anyone she did trust. We must be concerned with what concerns us, she said tightly, closing the door. Eldrith, have you found a new clue in those pages? Eldrith? The plump woman gave a start, then stared around at them, blinking. It was the first time she had raised her head from the battered yellow manuscript. She seemed surprised to see Leandrin. What? Clue? Oh, no. It is difficult enough getting into the king's library. If I extracted so much as a page, the librarians would know it immediately. But if I disposed of them, I would never find anything. That place is a maze. No, I found this in a bookseller's near the king's palace. It is an interesting treatise on... Embracing Sidar, Leandrin sent the pages showering across the floor. Unless they are a treatise on the controlling of Randall Thor, let them be burned. What have you learned about what we seek? Eldrith blinked at the scattered papers. Well, it is in the Panarch's palace. You learned that 2 days ago. And it must be a Turangrial. To control someone who can channel must require the power, and since it is a specialized use, that means a Turangrial. We will find it in the exhibition room, or perhaps among the Panarch's collection. Something new, Eldrith. With an effort, Leandrin made her voice less shrill. Have you found anything that is new? Anything? The round-faced woman blinked uncertainly. Actually, no. It does not matter, Marilyn said. In a few days, once they have invested their precious Panarch, we can begin searching, and if we must inspect every candlestick, we will find it. We are on the brink, Leandrin. We will put Randall Thor on a leash and teach him to sit up and roll over. Oh, yes, Eldrith said, smiling happily. On a leash. Leandrin hoped it was so. She was tired of waiting, tired of hiding. Let the world know her. Let people bend knee as had been promised when she first forswore old oaths for new. Egyanin knew she was not alone as soon as she stepped into her small house by the kitchen door, but she dropped her mask and the jute bag carelessly on the table and walked over to where a bucket of water stood beside the brick fireplace. As she bent to take the copper ladle, her right hand darted into a low hollow where two bricks had been removed behind the bucket. She spun erect, a small crossbow in her hand. No more than a foot long, it had little power or range, but she always kept it drawn, and the dark stain tipping the sharp steel bolt would kill in a heartbeat. If the man leaning casually in the corner saw the crossbow, he gave no outward sign. He was pale-haired and blue-eyed, in his middle years, and good-looking if too slender for her taste. Clearly he had watched her cross the narrow yard through the iron-grilled window beside him. "Do you think that I threaten you?" he said after a moment. She recognized the familiar accents of home, but she did not lower the crossbow. "Who are you?" For answer, he dipped two fingers carefully into his belt pouch. Apparently he could see, after all, and brought out something small and flat. She motioned him to lay it on the table and back up again. Only after he was back in the corner did she move close enough to pick up what he had set there. Never taking her eyes or the crossbow away from him, she lifted it up where she could see. A small ivory plaque, bordered in gold, engraved with a raven and a tower. The raven's eyes were black sapphires. A raven, symbol of the imperial family. The Tower of Ravens, symbol of imperial justice. "Normally this would be enough," she told him. "But we are far from Shan Chan, in a land where the bizarre is almost commonplace. What other proof can you offer?" Smiling with silent amusement, he removed his coat, unlaced his shirt, and stripped it off. On either shoulder was the tattoo of raven and tower. Most seekers for truth bore the ravens as well as the tower, but not even someone who dared steal a seeker's plaque would have himself marked so. To wear the ravens was to be the property of the imperial family. There was an old story of a fool young lord and lady who had themselves tattooed while drunk, some 300 years gone. When the then empress learned of it, she had them brought to the court of the 9 moons and set to scrubbing floors. This fellow might be one of their descendants. The mark of the raven was forever. "My apologies, seeker," she said, setting the crossbow down. "Why are you here?" She did not ask a name. Any he gave might or might not be his. He left her holding the plaque while he redressed himself in a leisurely manner, a subtle reminder. She was a captain and he property, but he was also a seeker, and under the law he could have her put to the question on his own authority. By law, he had the right to send her out to buy the rope to bind her while he put her to the question right here, and he would expect her to return with it. Flight from a seeker was a crime. Refusal to cooperate with a seeker was a crime. She had never in her life considered any criminal act, no more than she had considered treason against the Crystal Throne. But if he asked the wrong questions, demanded the wrong answers, the crossbow was still close to her hand, and Cantorin was far away. Wild thoughts. Dangerous thoughts. "I serve the High Lady Suroth and the Corenna for the Empress," he said. "I am checking on the progress of the agents the High Lady has placed in these lands." Checking? What had to be checked, and by a seeker? "I have heard nothing of this from the courier boats." His smile deepened, and she flushed. Of course the crews would not speak of a seeker. Yet he answered while lacing up his shirt, "The courier boats are not to be risked with my trips. I have taken passage on the vessels of a local smuggler, a man called Bael Domon. His craft stop everywhere in Tarabon and Arad Domon and between." "I have heard of him," she said calmly. "All goes well?" "It does now. I am glad that you, at least, understood your instructions properly. Among the others, only the seekers did. It is regrettable that there are not more seekers with the Hylene." Settling his coat on his shoulders, he plucked the seeker's plaque from her hand. There has been some embarrassment over the return of Suldam deserters. Such desertions must not become common knowledge. Much better that they simply vanish. Only because she had a little time to think was she able to keep her face smooth. Suldam had been left behind in the debacle at Falma, she had been told. Possibly some had deserted. Her instruction, delivered by the High Lady Suroth herself, had been to return any who could be found, whether they wanted to return or not, and if that was not possible, dispose of them. The last had seemed only a final alternative, until now. I regret that these lands do not know Kaff, he said, taking a seat at the table. Even in Cantorin, only the Bloods still have Kaff, or it was so when I left. Perhaps supply ships have arrived from Shanshan since. Tea must do. Fix me tea. She very nearly knocked him out of his chair. The man was property. And a seeker. She brewed tea and served it to him, standing beside his chair with the pot to keep his cup full. She was surprised he did not ask her to don a veil and dance on the table. She was permitted to sit at last, after fetching pen and ink and paper, but only to sketch maps of Tanchico and its defenses, to draw every other city and town she knew the least thing about. She listed the various forces in the field, as much as she knew of their strengths and loyalties, what she had deduced of their dispositions. When she was done, he stuffed it all in his pocket, told her to send the contents of the jute sack by the next courier boat, and left with one of those amused smiles, saying he might check on her progress again in a few weeks. She sat there for a long time after he was gone. Every map she had drawn, every list she had made, duplicated papers sent out by courier boats long since. Having her do it all again while he watched might have been a punishment for forcing him to show his tattoos. Death Watch guards flaunted their ravens. Seekers rarely did. It might have been that. At least he had not gone down to the basement before she arrived. Or had he? Had he just been waiting for her to speak? The stout iron lock hung seemingly undisturbed on the door in the hall just beyond the kitchen, but it was said Seekers knew how to open locks without keys. Taking the key from her belt pouch, she unfastened the lock and went down the narrow steps. One lamp on a shelf lit the dirt-floored basement. Just four brick walls, cleared of everything that might help an escape. A faint smell of the slop pail hung in the air. On the side opposite the lamp, a woman in a dirty dress sat despondently on a few rough woolen blankets. Her head lifted at the sound of Egyanin's steps, dark eyes fearful and pleading. She had been the first Suldam Egyanin had found, the first, the only. Egyanin had all but stopped looking after she found Bethamin. And Bethamin had been in this basement since, while courier boats came and went. Did anyone come down here? Egyanin said.
No. I heard footsteps overhead, but no.
Bethamin stretched out her hands.
Please, Egyanin, this is all a mistake. You have known me for 10 years. Take this thing off of me.
A silver collar encircled her neck, attached by a thick silver leash to a bracelet of the same metal that hung on a peg a few feet above her head. It had been almost an accident, putting it on her, simply a means of securing her for a few moments, and then she had managed to knock Egyanin down, trying a dash for freedom. If you bring it to me, I will, Egyanin said angrily. She was angry with many things, not with Bethamin. Bring the Eidam over here and I will remove it. Bethamin shivered, let her hands fall.
It is a mistake, she whispered. A horrible mistake.
But she made no move toward the bracelet. Her first attempted flight had left her writhing on the floor upstairs, racked by nausea, and had left Egyanin stunned. Suldam controlled Damani, women who could channel by means of Eidam. It was Damani who could channel, not Suldam. But an Eidam could only control a woman who could channel. No other woman, and not a man.
Young men with that ability were executed, of course. Only a woman who could channel. A woman who had that ability and was collared could not move more than a few steps without her bracelet on the wrist of a Suldam to complete the link. Egyanin felt very tired climbing the stairs and locking the door again. She wanted some tea herself, but the little the seeker had left was cold, and she did not feel like brewing more. Instead, she sat down and pulled the eidam out of the juked bag. To her, it was only finely jointed silver. She could not use it, and it could not harm her unless somebody hit her with it. Even linking herself with an eidam that far, denying its ability to control her, was enough to send a shiver down her spine. Women who could channel were dangerous animals rather than people. It had been they who broke the world. They must be controlled, or they would turn everyone into their property. That was what she had been taught, what had been taught in Seanchan for 1,000 years. Strange that that seemed not to have happened here. No, that was a dangerous, foolish line of thought. Tucking the eidam back into the bag, she cleaned the tea things to settle her mind. She liked tidiness, and there was a small satisfaction in making the kitchen so. Before she realized it, she was brewing a pot of tea for herself. She did not want to think about Bethamin, and that was dangerously foolish, too. Settling herself back at the table, she stirred honey into a cup of tea as black as she could make it. Not calf, but it would do. Despite her denials, despite her pleas, Bethamin could channel. Could other Suldam? Was that why the High Lady Suroth wanted those left behind at Falma killed? It was unthinkable. It was impossible. The yearly testings all across Seanchan found every girl who had the spark of channeling in her. Each was struck from the rolls of citizens, struck from family records, taken away to become collared Damani. The same testings found the girls who could learn to wear the bracelet of the Suldam. No woman escaped being tested each year, until she was old enough that she would have begun channeling if the spark was there. How could even one girl be taken for Suldam when she was Damani? Yet there Bethamin was in the basement, held by an eidam as by an anchor. One thing was certain. The possibilities here were potentially deadly. This involved the blood and seekers, maybe even the crystal throne. Would the High Lady Suroth dare keep knowledge of this sort from the Empress? A mere ship captain could die screaming for a misplaced frown in that company, or find herself property for a whim. She had to know more if she hoped to avoid the death of 10,000 tears. To begin with, that meant spreading more money to Gelb and other ferrety skulkers like him, finding more Suldam and seeing if Eidam held them. Beyond that, she was sailing uncharted reefs, with no linesman in the bow. Touching the crossbow still lying there with its lethal bolt, she realized that something else was certain. She was not going to let the seekers kill her. Not just to help the High Lady Suroth keep a secret. Perhaps not for any reason. It was a thought shiveringly close to treason, but it would not go away.